As I was preparing this morning, or for this morning, it seemed to me like the gospel was explained or gave us some context to understand its meaning. The gospel's context was provided by the first passage from Jeremiah. So I want to talk about this whole theme, this idea of the God as the potter being in control, complete and absolute control over the creation and humans, both collectively as a nation or as a church and individually. But I thought initially of a poster or a t-shirt, I can't remember what it was years ago I saw, and it read something like this. I'm pretty sure it was supposed to be humorous, but there's probably, the person displaying the poster or t-shirt probably had a point they were trying to make as well, and it said something like this: "We will get along splendidly once you realize that I'm God." Right? So, and there is some truth to that. That is, if everyone else in your life deferred to you as if you were God, you would have very few arguments or dissatisfactions, right? Until you just completely imploded on your own excess. But this idea, the t-shirt, the poster, was coined first by the prophet Jeremiah, because this is what part of what the plea in Jeremiah is. God is reminding his people, the Jewish people, that he can do whatever he chooses with them, because like a potter has complete and absolute authority and sway over the material with which the potter is working, so too God has in the lives of people and in the fate and the destiny of nations. So the prophet goes on. So this is the image, the prophetic image or object lesson that Jeremiah is using. First of all, God takes Jeremiah to the potter's house. And as Jeremiah is observing exactly what happens, probably you're familiar with this at some level, either in watching it in film or perhaps, back in the day when they made you take shop when you were in high school, you might have actually tried throwing something on a wheel, a potter's wheel. But as Jeremiah observes, the potter is frustrated in his plans and his design, and so he just puts it back to a lump of clay and he begins again. And then God says, "This is the way I relate to people, with the same level of freedom and the same ability to remake, so that if I have promised to build a nation and plant a nation, if it turns out that they do not follow me, then I can bring judgment upon that nation, uproot them, not plant them. And conversely, if I pronounce judgment upon a nation and they begin to live righteously, then I will build them." So, this introduces, I think, a developmental challenge for us. And I'm using the words, I'm consciously trying to sort of do a metaphor or a comparison with developmental psychology. So developmental psychology tells us that beginning with infants, in fact, beginning in the womb, you could say, but people, in order to develop fully, have to kind of hit some critical developmental stages. There's these things that, for instance, if a child doesn't learn to speak when they're two or whatever it is, I don't know what the window is, then speech comes very difficult later. And in fact, the child, for whatever reason, maybe what caused the speech delay in the first place. But so if you're a parent and your child isn't developing at the right stage, the right sorts of things, then it's a reason to be concerned and to intervene. You don't wait till they're 16 and say, "Why do you still grunt? Haven't you learned how to..." A little late then, right? So And there's a lot of these developmental stages. Well, this, I believe, is something that happens to every human who's going to follow God. That one of the things that happens is they come up against this reality that God is God and they are not. And that is a critical point. It's a crisis time because there's no place. You're either going to go through that and come out on the other side and move forward in life, or you're going to retreat and regress in life. That's the way these critical developmental stages are. Right? Children who don't make it through the developmental stage, they regress in their development. They don't progress. And so, as a Christian, as a human, who wants to encounter God, there's lots of things, and we could talk about how you begin, like salvation itself is a crisis time, a critical time, where you either do or you don't, but you don't kind of hang out there. But this is another one of these post-salvation, post-conversion. At some point in time, you're going to come up square against this fact that God is God and you are not, and you're going to be offended by that. This is a crisis, it's a wall, because you respond to this. You're like, well, just wait a minute. You really expect me to do that? To give that? To release that? And he says, well, yes, I'm God, you're not. So that's the terms under which we are in relationship. So I think this helps us understand the gospel. Probably like me, you just sort of ignore these things when Jesus says, unless a man takes up, or unless a person takes up their cross daily, as Matthew adds, I think, and follows me, they cannot be my disciple. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, Jesus. Oh, you're such a guy. Full of hyperbole, that boy, eh? Always, you know, hyperbole is, right? Overstating the case. You're like, as if, Jesus, you expect me to take up a cross. That's just funny. Well, okay, I don't go quite that far. But I just ignore it. I'm like, ah, la, 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 I can't hear you. Da, da, da. Because my life is way simpler. Way simpler. When I tell myself, I can follow Jesus, but I don't need to take up my cross. That is optional or negotiable. But that isn't what Jesus says. And so this passage tells us three times what has to happen or you cannot be a follower of Jesus or a disciple. First of all, an individual must hate husband, wife, sister, brother, mother, father, yea, their own life, or they cannot be my disciple. Secondly, a person must take up their cross, which again is just restating the same thing, or they cannot be my disciple. Thirdly, and I apologize that that piece of the gospel didn't make it into your bulletin, but John read that for us. Even so, a man who does not give up, or a person who does not give up all their possessions, does not renounce all their possessions, they cannot be my disciple. Now, these are hard words, I think. And I think it's better, well, okay, I'll tell you what one misunderstanding is that I've had, and I assume is fairly common. And that is that we picture this somewhat like a college entrance application. And so we're filling out the application. We're like, da, da, da. And there's this thing like, take up your cross and follow. I'm like, maybe not. See below for comments. And then renounce all that you own. Yeah, probably about that. See comments below. And so then this application gets up to heaven there. And Jesus is like looking at stuff. He's like, guys, why am I even reading this thing? That's a reject. And he just tosses it out. If they didn't check yes, that's an automatic reject. But that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is not saying, I will not receive you. What does Jesus say? Any who wishes may come. Come. I am offering living water. Come, receive. I'm offering abundant life. Come, receive. But then Jesus says, but you really can't come unless certain things are in place. So it's better to see this not as a choice that Jesus is making. It's better, I think, to see it as a statement of fact. So that I could say to you,
Folks, you aren't going to be alive tomorrow unless you breathe today. You cannot be alive tomorrow without breathing today. Well, stupid example, right? But I could say to you, you're not going to be here 6 months from now unless you eat something in the next 6 months. Probably going to want to eat regularly. But you're not going to live for 6 months without eating. You cannot be here 6 months from now unless you eat. And you say, well, Oz, that's very unfair. How can you tell me that I cannot be alive 6 months from now? I'm like, not my choice, not my decision. I'm giving you a fact. And so that is what Jesus is saying. He's saying this, brothers and sisters. At a certain point in time, you're going to come hard up against the reality that God is God and you are not. And you're going to shout back that you very much prefer to consider yourself God, at least in your own world, and that you would like to negotiate those terms. And if you don't resolve that successfully, you will not be my disciple. Plain and simple, there's no discipleship until you resolve that successfully by saying, as Jesus said, not my will, but thine be done. The book of Hebrews tells us that Jesus learned obedience though he was a son. And I think, along with some others, that the writer to the Hebrews is pointing to that moment in the garden where Jesus prays. It probably wasn't the first time he prayed this, but it was a very intense prayer. As Luke tells us, Jesus praying this, wrestling with this, sweated drops of blood. And Jesus says, is there any other way, Father? And then he says, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. If even Jesus hit this wall, if even Jesus hit a critical developmental stage that he had to resolve positively so that he might move forward beyond that into the will of God and into the glory of service of God, then how much more you and I? So this is something that I'm convinced. Now, I might be wrong. I don't know everything. And I have made mistakes in the past, to be sure. But I'm convinced that every Christian is going to face this at some point in time or the other. And maybe you've already faced it. And you could say, yeah, let me tell you about 20 years ago or 50 years ago. And God and I, we had it out. We hammered it out. And I gave up. I surrendered. Or maybe it's going to come, but it will happen, because until it does, you're just following Jesus. You're not a disciple of Jesus. You're just one of these onlookers. You're part of the bandwagon, but you haven't really signed up, because you only sign up when you resolve this issue. You're God and I'm not. Now, I remember my own life. This was a long, long thing. Talk about, you know, developmental stages. This one's probably still stretching out. But there were some critical points in time in this. And one time in particular, as a young man, trying to live for God as an adult decision, I was 20-something, I'm not sure entirely how old I was. And I was reading Romans 9. In Romans 9, Paul takes the same image of God as the potter. And he says, it's entirely up to God who gets saved and who gets judged. Entirely up to God. And he develops his argument for it. And I was horrified by this. And you can go home tonight, this afternoon, read Romans 9. This begins somewhere around verse 20. And be duly horrified yourself. I recommend it. It's a good, healthy thing to do. Because Paul gets this statement where he says, after he said that God will have mercy on whom he chooses and he'll harden whom he chooses. He did that in the womb with Jacob and Esau. Before they did anything, before they were even born, he chose Jacob and he dismissed Esau. And Paul says, so then it matters not about the human who runs, who strives, or the human who desires or wills, but God who has mercy. And I remember just going, what the heck then? Like, how does that make sense? How is that? And I was horrified. Now, I think God and I successfully resolved that issue, but like I said, it didn't finish the issue. I'm great at negotiating things with God. trying to negotiate things with God. He wins in the end. God be praised. Mm-hmm. So now, this doctrine is something we're all going to have to live through in order, as I said, to continue to grow as Christians. May have happened, maybe ongoing, maybe something in the future. But the doctrine itself has two possible responses. The first is to be horrified, like I said, by this. Now, the Psalm 139 skips over some pieces, but even what we read is enough to horrify you. God, you know me, you've searched me, there's nothing I do, but you know it already. Even what I'm going to say has already been planned by you. You know it. You formed me, you shaped me. But the psalmist says that's a wonderful thing. But like the child who's anxious about Santa Claus, because Santa Claus knows what you're doing, right? He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows. It's like, Santa Claus is the last guy I want to meet. Some of us might be horrified and fearful of this. The very fact that God is sovereign and God is God and I'm not is not a thing of comfort for me if I have difficulties with either not being God or I have difficulties with an abusive understanding of God, an abusive understanding of religion. So the Jewish people, the first listeners in Jeremiah, they respond in a way, so they're at this crisis, they're at a critical moment, and they regress, they back off, and they say to themselves, it's no use, we will just live according to the stubbornness of our own heart. Maybe you've heard your own heart witness or testify that. I know I have in the past at times too. Just said, you know what, God? I know you don't want me to, you know, but I think I'm probably just going to go on doing this because I'm kind of stuck, kind of in a rut. I don't know. I think the Jewish people are just being flippant, but who knows? So I love the way the psalmist ends. Because he knows, well, the Spirit knows that this might not be a comforting thing. You could read Psalm 139, where the psalmist says, where can I flee from your presence? If I, you know, go down to hell, you're there already. If I go up to heaven, you're there. If even the night doesn't cover me, because the day and the night are alike to you. Light, night is like dark. Night is like light to you. And that could be a place where we don't feel safe and we don't feel comfortable. We may find our own heart saying, what's the use? I can't change. Why would I even try again? Why would I even hope? Why would I let this preacher talk me into doing something I know is completely futile and meaningless? And the psalmist points us to a response for either condition and for the positive condition. Since you are God and I'm not, then Lord, search me. And try me. I can't save myself. You save me. This is such a comforting word. Because I can quit trying to save myself. Some mornings I can't even tie my shoes. Let alone save myself. But I'm not required to save myself. And so the psalmist says, Lord, you search me and know me and try my heart. See if there be in me any hurtful way. Because I don't know myself and I can't be honest with myself and I can deceive myself. So Lord, you search me and try me and know me and lead me in the way everlasting. So pray with me and I will let David be our prayer guide. Psalm 139, verse 23. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me, know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Amen.